The matter of Beryl Zimmerman and Judy Comment versus Sussex County Educational Services Commission. Appearances, please.
It pleases the court, Brent Pullman, FS on Werbel, on behalf of the appellant, Sussex County Educational Services Commission.
Donna Ahrens, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the Commissioner of Education.
Louis Buseri, on behalf of Ms. Comment and Ms. Zimmerman.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Pullman.
Chief Justice, Justice of the Court, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and argue this matter on behalf of my client. We are here in review of an appellate division decision which undermines 40 years of jurisprudence and administrative decisions regarding the Employer-Employee Relations Act and essentially rewrote a portion of the Tenure Act. The question presented was, are tenured part-time employees who worked on an as-needed basis with a fluctuating work schedule, weekly work schedule, throughout the course of their employment, who have no collectively negotiated guaranteed minimum hours, entitled to a minimum number of hours under the Tenure Act or a minimum amount of compensation? The overarching question is, what are the emoluments of tenure for such employees? It's important to start by understanding who the employer is. The Sussex County Educational Services Commission is a public entity that provides special education services to students residing in Sussex County and who are enrolled in non-public schools. Their obligation, and they were a statutorily created entity that exists to provide, enable public schools to meet their obligation to provide special education services to students who reside within their district but attend non-public schools. At issue here are the services of Chapter 192 services, 193 services, and IDEIA. 192 you might understand to be compensatory education, reading, writing, math, English as a second language, or home instruction. Chapter 193 services are special education services, so evaluations and eligibility determinations, speech evaluations, and supplemental instruction needed for eligible students. And then IDEA, or Individual with Disabilities Education Improvement Act services, include pull-out or supplementary services, in-class push-in supports, and occupational and physical therapies. So we've talked about the students, we've talked about the commissions. Folks and listeners have an understanding of the commission's funding. Unlike the majority of public educational providers in the state, they do not have a tax base off of which they obtain funds. The commission receives its funding from the home school districts who are engage or contract with the commission to provide the needed services to the students who reside in their district but are attending non-public schools. So who are the petitioners? The petitioners in this instance are tenured part-time teachers who worked on an as-needed basis to provide various special education services to the students that were serviced by the commission. There is no undisputed that there was a variation in their regular hours worked throughout the entirety of their employment. Their annual employment contracts did not provide for any guaranteed minimum hours, nor did their collectively negotiated agreement. In fact, in some years, Ms. Zimmerman worked as few as 3 hours per week and as much as 28 hours per week. Ms. Comment worked as few as 17 hours per week and as many as 28 hours per week. Both had annual employment contracts, which indicated that they were part-time teachers who were to be paid a negotiated hourly rate. Since it's not undisputed that they were not full-time teachers, nor were they part-time teachers who were contracted for a set amount. And what I mean is they weren't teachers who were a two-fifths teacher or a three-fifths teacher or a four-fifths teacher, which is the way that when we discuss part-time teachers who have annual contracts that guarantee their amount of time, that's how they're referred to. And you can think of, you know, two-fifths as 12 hours, three-fifths as 18, four-fifths as 24. So knowing all this and then looking at the controlling collective agreement, we see that the parties negotiating it differentiated and accounted for the differences in these employees' employment. There is a salary guide for full-time certified staff, as well as a separate guide for part-time certificated staff. Full-time employees were paid a negotiated annual salary who worked 7 hours per day, 5 days per week for 35 hours, and part-time employees were paid a negotiated hourly rate for each hour worked. They had no set hours, nor minimum daily or weekly requirement. So what are these petitioners' rights? Well, it's undisputed in this case that they do have tenure. That has been long held since set forth by this court in the Spiewicz decision. So no employee shall be dismissed or reduced in compensation except for inefficiency, incapacity, conduct unbecoming. But if it were that simple, we wouldn't be here, because obviously we have different circumstances, because these petitioners were employed under different circumstances than almost every other teacher in the state of New Jersey. Obviously, full-time teachers, you generally, through their negotiated agreement, either have an annual salary or a set rate for hours worked, and there's agreed amount for those hours worked. Or, if you're a part-time teacher, you can be paid an hourly rate, or you can be paid percentage of what the full-time teachers would earn off of their salary guide. But a part-time teacher, in the more common circumstances which have been addressed by the courts, are teachers who are each year received a contract to, say, work 9 hours per week, 18 hours per week, 24 hours per week. And that's obviously not what we're dealing with here.
So suppose the plaintiff's hours had been reduced to 1 hour per week, week after week. Would that amount to a reduction in compensation if the non-tenured teachers either maintained the same hours that they had historically had or their hours were increased?
Well, it's our position that these teachers in and of themselves, for tenure for them, did not guarantee them any minimum weekly hourly amount.
So is it your understanding of the Tenure Act that you could, in effect, box out the tenured employees and give more hours to those who are not tenured? While reducing the tenured employees' hours?
It would be it'd be permissible and to be done under the terms of the collective agreement.
So what does tenure, given the questions that were posed to you by the Chief Justice, what does tenure mean for a tenured part-time teacher in circumstances like this?
It means nothing from what I'm
hearing from you.
It means that they have the right to remain on the list to be called for the work when it becomes available. And they have the right, and their hourly rate, which has been negotiated, cannot be reduced.
So,
but if their hourly rate remains the same or even higher as it was in this instance, it was bumped up a little bit from one year to the next, and their hours are reduced to the levels that the chief suggested, say 1 hour or fewer per week, while non-tenured or less senior people are given more time, why is that not a direct violation of the statute, not the contract? And the reason I point you to that, because in Spiewicz, this court said whether they're entitled, a teacher's entitled to tenure doesn't depend on the contractual agreement.
No, but in Spiewicz, the court also noted in a footnote 3 that in order to determine what the benefits of tenure or what the emoluments of tenure were for those employees who had brought that claim, you have to go back and look at the collectively negotiated agreement. And that was, again, reiterated 3 years later.
If we accept that argument, that reads out from the statute reduction in compensation, does it not?
Well, that comes down to defining what is compensation.
How do you define it?
And that's where we look over to the Employer-Employee Relations Act, and we say, what is compensation? And that begins at Spiewicz, where the court said to go look at the collective agreement, and then in REA versus Rutherford, 3 years later, where different plaintiffs who had the same similar situation at Spiewicz, but they had not been, I guess, in the pipeline at the time, came back and brought claims regarding our part-time work. And again, the court said, it is not for us to determine the emoluments or compensation for these employees, but rather to look at the collective negotiations agreement.
So I want to understand your argument, and I'm going to pivot again off of Chief Justice's question. So assume that the teacher, or one of the plaintiffs, worked 300 hours in the previous year at $50 an hour, and the next year that teacher works one, they give her 1 hour and give the 299 hours to make up for it to a non-tenured teacher at $15 an hour. Your argument is that's okay under the Tenure Act.
Yes.
Don't you have to read the Tenure Act with the seniority statutes? And in other words, we have no idea how many hours, whether there's a need for this service, how many hours were given to the tenured teacher, and how many hours were given to less senior teachers. In other words, maybe what you're saying is correct with respect to Justice Alvin's hypothetical, But if the other 299 hours were given to teachers that's needed service with less seniority and non-tenured, wouldn't they be correct? Wouldn't they have a claim there?
Well, no, because it was the nature of this way this position was created. It derives out of the amount and need for this position is the fluctuation is what creates it. So these teachers are providing services across.
But that's by total number of students. In other words, student need or every student's IEP plus every service, they come up with a number. I'm saying to you there are 300 hours required. We don't know any of this, by the way. None of this is in the records.
It is not, Your Honor.
There's 300 hours of required service in year one, under Justice Alden's hypothetical. There's 300 hours of required service year two, based upon that formula that the district comes up with, the number of children, number of hours, number of services. And year one, 299 hours go to tenured teacher. In year two, 299 is out. 99 hours go to non-tenured, less senior teachers. You're saying that's perfectly fine.
Yes, because and the reason for that is when we look at Local 195, and so Local 195 tells us how do we determine if something is subject to negotiation, and this court established a three-prong test, and the first prong obviously is it intimately and directly affects the work and welfare, is it preempted by statute or regulation, and would negotiation significantly interfere with government policy prerogative or determination. And time again, this court and various administrative entities have held that work hours and compensation fall within the scope of negotiation.
Why don't we look, as Justice LaVecchia was asking you to do earlier, just at the plain language of the statute, which speaks to reduction in compensation. Compensation, in common use, is payment for work. Does the fact that the hourly rate doesn't change miss the mark if we're trying to assess a reduction in compensation?
Well, compensation is what's defined by the parties through the negotiations. And similarly...
You mean the parties can override the statutory meaning?
Well, the appellate division created a definition of compensation that said annual salary, but that doesn't exist anywhere. They said that they think that's what it should be. Compensation is left to be negotiated to determine what are the elements of compensation.
So take this collective negotiation agreement. They didn't put the number of hours because they're a moving target. They weren't able to determine that. So why would we read the collective negotiation agreement, which is silent on the hours, as somehow undermining or contravening the Tenure Act?
I don't believe it undermines it or contravenes it. It's left to the Tenure Act leaves it to the parties, and it's their responsibility to set what compensation will be.
So you have a strong argument when you're talking about a fluctuation based on need. The thrust of the questions you've received are fluctuation that are based on determinations about who should get the hours that are genuinely needed. Do you see no distinction between those two?
Well, there certainly is a distinction as far as what exists and who's entitled to it. If there's a need for, in the September of this year, there's a need for a total of 1,000 hours for the month. And then the question is, how is that divided? Traditionally, when we look at employees' tenure rights, they can be established by reviewing were they a full-time employee. If they were a part-time employee, we look at their fractional tenure and we determine what that was. However, here, the employees certainly were not full-time. That's not in dispute. And their employment fluctuated within the year.
Yeah, but your scheme is incentivizing the board to...
cut out the tenured teachers.
Yeah, cut them out.
Yeah.
I'll look for a person who just started, I'll pay him $15 an hour. It's paying you, tenured teacher, $30 an hour when I've now just convinced the Supreme Court was convinced I can hire someone for $15 an hour who just got out of school.
That's
basically the paradigm that you're asking us to accept, no?
Well, if it falls to the unit representative for the teachers to negotiate what compensation is going to be for them. And it's ultimately their responsibility
know the number of hours. They can't figure that out because it may be fluctuating during the course of the year, how many students are entering the district and what their needs are. So they don't pin a number. Does that mean that the board can therefore wind up giving work, the same work, to a non-tenured less senior person for half the pay?
Well, just like you said, because it fluctuates within the year, you can't make assignment and seniority determinations within a school year. If a student left, would then another teacher, would we have to take a more senior teacher and give them hours and work that had been assigned in the middle of a school year to another teacher? It's the very nature of this position that that the flexibility arises from.
And but in this record, I thought there was agreement that the reduction in hours to the two petitioners was not due to an increase in need of services.
The basis for the reduction to these petitioners was that there was a managerial decision made to no longer have 192 and 193 services provided in groups of less than three. And also, there was a determination by the administration that these particular employees did not possess the necessary certification.
Was that in the record, or was that submitted not subject to the adversarial system, but as an affidavit later on?
With respect to that was submitted by an affidavit in support by the superintendent for the Sussex County Educational Services.
But was it submitted before the administrative law judge?
I believe that it was in our motion for summary judgment, Your Honor.
Under your description of the amount of flexibility that management has with regard to assigning this work, particularly with regard to bringing in a non-tenured teacher, suppose the reason for bringing a particular non-tenured teacher into the setting was because that person was of a particular political party. You would agree that that would not be permitted under the tenure statute, would you not?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So if that's true, then you're admitting that there has some protection to the amount of hours that the individual petitioners here are entitled to receive, or at least have divvied up in some equitable fashion by the management, above a certain class of other individuals.
Justice, I would say that that example is also brings into the First Amendment rights of the employee who may have lost hours, and so that would be a separate basis for a cause of action.
I'm trying to understand the limits of, if any, on the amount of managerial discretion you feel the Board of Education has in terms of giving assignment of work to the two petitioners.
I think in this instance, given the nature of this employment, they have absolute discretion, because there's no way to calculate these employees what they're...
Can they bring the hours down to zero?
Under this, yes.
Well, then isn't that dismissal, removal from
position? That would be under zero, it would be a termination, and they couldn't be terminated without and this is about tenure charges being brought against them.
But one hour for the year would be okay.
Under the one for the year, it's never practical that that's going to happen, that they get 1 hour for a year. But that's the position that we're making, is that there's no way that you can, unless you were to treat them as fractional employees. You were to say they had fractional tenure, and you were to look back to what was the consistent amount of hours that they worked during the period of time in which they were in tenure during those mm-hmm. first 3 years, then because of their fluctuating schedule, there's no way to calculate what their tenure right would be, because their hours changed within the year and year to year, and they never received a contract saying that you're going to work the same amount of hours.
I'm trying to figure out what benefit they get other than that 1 hour.
Yeah.
From the Tenure Act.
Well,
what's the benefit to these teachers?
In this case, it's
they're part of a group, and no matter whatever we say with respect to these two teachers, will apply to all such teachers. I want to know what benefit are they getting from the Tenure Act? If you're saying that a board can save money by cutting all their hours out, reducing them to one, and paying a first-year teacher half their salary.
I mean, unfortunately, it falls to their union to negotiate them a minimum amount of hours, or to negotiate a process by which hours would be assigned.
But you would agree that the board can't act arbitrarily and capriciously, would you not?
Yes.
Okay. So how does one, if at all, evaluate the kind of managerial discretion that you're suggesting the board has when there is no way of assessing the decision to give non-tenured 192-193 teachers like these work that diminishes the amount of tenured people. I'm not suggesting comparing tenured to tenured and coming up with some equitable distribution of as-needed work among that class of individuals. But once you introduce a non-tenured person into the mix of the assignment of hours, how does that not reach a question of arbitrary and capriciousness on the part of the board?
Well, because especially when you look at the facts particular to their employment. Here, you had employees who have the right to not accept work. You have employees who have to cover areas, a vast area. And this decision, certainly.
When you say vast area, is there a logistic aspect to
these? Oh, yes, there certainly is a logistic aspect.
Well, why didn't the board say that?
That in this particular instance, because the reduction in this particular instance, Your Honor, was a result of the reduction in number of classes because of having more students and because of the determination by the superintendent that these two particular teachers were no longer eligible to teach the IDEA 193 programs.
Just explain that, if you would, how those two things fit together, because there was a change, obviously, three and above per class. That reduces the number of both 192 and 193 classes. And so the second part of that, which is what the determination is to their certifications, would be that they were limited to the 192 classes and there were fewer of them. Is that the issue?
That's correct.
And were the non-tenured teachers who got the additional hours certified in both?
Not all of them, no. And that was not developed before the administrative law judge.
So it seems as if the defense of this particular factual scenario in this case is not about distance within Sussex County for the commission has to assign teachers, but it's about a change that reduced the total number of classes in the two categories and a determination that these two individuals, for at least it's the commission's contention, are not qualified to teach one of the two categories that were there, which confined them to the other category. Am I right about that?
That is correct.
Okay. So we don't know how the other teachers differed in terms of their qualifications and experience, in the board's
view. Nor does the record have the assignment of work.
But we do know that the hourly rates were very different.
Yes.
Was there any evidence offered by the commission regarding any rationale or reason other than the class size, this number of students being increased from 2 to 3, any other reason as to why their hours were reduced and apparently more hours were given to non-tenured, less senior teachers? In other words, what did they provide any reason, and were they required to provide any reason? I think from you they're not required to.
Well,
but the record doesn't tell us.
In this case, it's not just the reduction from 2 to 3.
Right.
It's also the determination by the administration that these two teachers were not eligible to teach the 193 classes.
Was that ever quantified and presented to the hearing officer?
No, it was not.
Was it challenged?
I do believe that the petitioners challenged the legal position that they are not eligible to teach 193.
You contest the appellate division's methodology, which isn't really, as I read the opinion, not completely played out in terms of how it would apply here, but it's basically based on a percentage of hours. Each tenured teacher would be entitled to work based on seniority, then the educational needs, and then a multiplication between the two. Does that miss the question of who is qualified to perform what category of work?
Yes.
Tell us, if you would, how that could play out if that methodology were imposed, and you had, for example, a demand for one particular category of educational services, and a lack of demand for the other.
Certainly, and actually, I'm going to expand a little further on that and show how it could actually create a greater level of benefit that's in contradiction to the Tenure Act. So, if we presume that for the 14-15 school year, which is the school year at question here, there were enough hours of 192, 193, and IDEA for, let's say, 20 hours per week per employee who was doing that at the time. So there were 8 employees, and the record reflects that. And if we had enough for 20 hours per week for those employees, that would bring us to approximately 6,400 hours for the year. Now, those 8 employees, Ms. Comet had 21 years of service, and Ms. Zimmerman had 16 years of service, and the remaining 6 had between 4 and 7. So a total amount of 66 years of service for those employees. Now, and this is going along with the appellate division's seniority percentage that they derived. Now, of that 66, Ms. Comet's percentage would be 32%, because her 21 is 32% of 66. Ms. Zimmerman, she would have 24%, which is 16% of 66. So of those 6,400 hours that would be available, which if there were 20 hours per week, which would actually, if we think about 20 hours per week, is a reduction still for them, because mm-hmm. in some years mm-hmm. they were working
more.
But if they were to receive a long seniority privilege, so if Ms. Comet was to get 32% of the hours available from under my hypothetical, she would be entitled to 2,048 hours. And at her hourly rate for that year, she would have earned $72,478. Now, the year before, in 13-14, she worked 1,117 hours and earned $3,600.
$36,000.
No one up here is suggesting a percentage. We're talking about reduction in compensation. There may be all sorts of justifiable reasons for giving non-tenured. You mentioned geography. Maybe the tenured teacher cannot teach something that the non-tenured teacher. Those are all seemingly legitimate factors. But what you're telling us is that a tenured person can just have all his or her hours removed and given to a lesser-paying non-tenured person. And you're saying that's perfectly okay under the Tenure Act, correct?
Not in every position, certainly not. It's the specific facts of this case. I mean, obviously, the tenure determinations for full-time and part-time employees who have fractional tenure have been set and established.
Can I take you back to just finish the line of questioning that we're talking about? Because we are reviewing a decision that imposed a methodology. And I just want to say, is it the commission's position, if you know, or if there is one, that there were not 2,048 hours available to Ms. Comet that were involved teaching services as to which she had the qualifications?
That I do not know. I don't know.
Okay, but am I correct that one of your criticisms of the formula that was the appellate division imposed is it doesn't take into account that these are distinct individuals with different qualifications and experience who may not be the right person for each hour of services to the child?
I have 2 major criticisms. The first is what you just said, is that it attributes a percentage of work regardless of their qualifications for the work. The second issue that we have is that it actually creates a system under which they would be entitled to more work than they had ever had, because it would essentially come to handcuff the commission, because they could never hire anybody else without these people refusing work. Because once you entitle them to a percentage of work, they now have an entitlement to that percentage going forward.
So the appellate division expressly says, we're not saying this is the only way to do it.
Right.
Agency, use your expertise to devise any other reasonable means to determine annual income and then apply the term compensation to the Tenure Act. I take it the agency has not done that during the pendency of this litigation.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
But do you read it differently?
No.
I don't see the APTIV as directing a singular formula that must be followed.
Well, they certainly highly suggested that formula and
correct. They
included enough in their decision to say this is how we think it should be done. But they did also have the language referring to the agency and its expertise.
But if your position is 1 hour is adequate based on your reading of the law, there's no need for any formula.
Well, no, I think you can develop a formula that would be appropriate within the existing jurisprudence.
Do you have a proposal, or do you
if you were to ask, I would look at I think you look at fractional tenure. I mean, there's certainly a way to to analyze these employees in that context. Is it more difficult? Yes, because for no one's tracked that information for almost 40 years. Because
say a little bit more about what you mean.
So the issue would be, if we were to look at fractional tenure, we would say, when these employees were hired and when they earned tenure, what were they working then? And then you would look at and you would say, was there any period after that in which they worked the same amount of hours? So and it's very difficult in this case because we don't have all this information, but let's say when they were hired, they were working 10 hours a week. And they did that for the 3 years. And on third in a day, they're now tenured employees. Well, 10 hours a day isn't a full-time employee. It's in between a 2/5 and a 3/5, but it's a fractional employment. And so you have fractional tenure. And you then would look at them, well, is there any other time where maybe they worked, because there's case law certain where employees were part-time employees and then they worked full-time hours and your tenure can change. And if you were to make a determination that type of, that methodology could be applied to them, although going back in time would be difficult, but certainly a record should exist, that would be probably certainly a more fair way to determine what their tenure is.
But how would it play out? Would that amount to a minimum number of hours that they were entitled to if they were a 2/5
and so the difficulty is then, and this is where the nature of this becomes difficult, because when you're a 2/5 teacher, and if you don't have the job anymore, well then you effectuate a reduction in force, and it's an act taken by the public entity. They vote, they reduce in force, and then if there's individuals who you would have seniority rights over for a part-time position, or in some cases the law would allow for a full-time position, you can exercise those rights. In this case, these employees aren't reduced. There's not a formal reduction in force because one, they're never, each year they're not guaranteed a set number of hours, and their hours are constantly changing due to need.
Do you feel that they had no expectation, no legitimate expectation that they would be entitled to continue doing work for which they're certificated to do and had been doing before it went to a non-tenured teacher?
Well, I think that would depend on the specifics of the geography of providing the services.
I don't exactly know what that means. If you're suggesting that because of the logistics and the need to travel, it was not physically possible for two people to cover the times at which classes needed to be taught at the non-public school locations when the students needed those services, and therefore there was an impossibility of performance, if you will. You needed to go to an additional person. Then I guess that makes some sense. But is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I'm raising that in this instance, Your Honor, because as Justin Albin said, this is going to have long-lasting impacts across the state, and that's certainly a factor that needs to be considered in determining an employee's right to employment. Because we also don't set these students' schedules. You know, the non-public school sets their schedule, and we have to provide services at the times that they say they're needed.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's difficult. It's a different situation than when you have your own school district. You're in the same district, and you can even travel building to building to provide services than when we're looking at this area. So it's a factor that has to be considered in determining one of many factors, such as availability of work and eligibility to provide the service.
Okay, so that's a rather long way to get at the question I was asking. Is there no expectation that the individual would be entitled to work, assuming the logistics is not the answer to my question, before the work goes to a non-tenured person?
Given what we've seen in Alfieri and Kuteris, that because they've never been guaranteed a minimum number of hours and have never worked consistent hours, they don't have a right to any specific amount of time.
So your answer to me is responding that the contract overrides whatever statutory protection the Tenure Act meant to provide to these part-time individuals. Is that correct?
I think they work together. That the Tenure Act says that there can be a reduction in compensation.
There cannot be
a reduction in compensation. And then the Employer-Employee Relations Act and all of the cases that have come down through the years say, well, what compensation constitutes is to be determined and negotiated by the parties. And in this case, they didn't just negotiate an hourly rate for whatever hours they're assigned. And they would never negotiate a minimum number of hours nor an annual salary.
But that doesn't mean that they were negotiating a contract in violation of the statute. That doesn't mean that the people who drafted the collective negotiation agreement were acceding to a reduction of their hours to 1 hour, correct?
Well, I mean, 1 hour is a harsh example.
Well, whatever.
Decisions which have said that you can negotiate to reduce compensation, and that you can negotiate, and that the idea that
so for the people who are negotiating the agreement, if they're giving flexibility, it seems to me they're giving flexibility to the board because they can't determine at the point that they're negotiating the contract the number of hours. So merely by not putting the number of hours doesn't mean that the board is now being given authority to act in bad faith to undermine the tenure rights of the part-time teachers.
Well, I don't think there's been any evidence of bad faith in this instance.
No.
I think we have your position. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ahrens?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. No one disputes that these teachers who are employed on an hourly, as-needed basis have tenure status, nor does anyone dispute that the tenure law protects tenure teachers from a reduction in compensation. As you've been discussing, the case really boils down to a question of what that tenure guarantee, that protection against a reduction in compensation, means in the context of these teachers with the employment contract that they have. The tenure law doesn't define compensation, and it certainly doesn't say that their annual compensation can't be reduced. It just says their compensation can't be reduced. And in SPIWAC, or however you say it, SPIWAC, this court stated that you look to their employment contract to determine the nature of that compensation. So it's not, Justice Lavecchia, a question of contract overriding tenure rights. They work together. The contract, the employment contract, provides the substance of the compensation that is protected by the tenure law. And that what is negotiated by the parties in the employment contract, that compensation level can't be reduced. The tenure law protects people in positions, and positions have different levels of compensation, and there's no set salary guide or payment schedule for the state. Each district gets to negotiate their own. Now, these teachers, usually when we think of tenure, we think of full-time teachers that are given 180 days. They commit to work 180 days for the district, and in return they receive an annual salary. And the district commits to employ them for 180 days. And so their compensation is sort of inextricably intertwined with the amount of time that they're going to work. These teachers, in this case, agreed to work on an hourly basis, but they had no set number of hours.
You've heard the examples that we asked your colleague. At some level, and tell me if you disagree, do they render meaningless the protection if all you're looking at is the hourly rate and can reduce the hours to the barest minimum number?
So I agree that is certainly giving me pause, and I'm sure everyone on this court pause, because that's a very uncomfortable thought. For one thing, to start with, the tenure law does protect teachers who are RIFed, and this, if there were, there can be a RIF in this context. So for example, in this case, 8 teachers, I guess, they were assigned to maybe, say they're each assigned to a school. And the district, the Educational Services Commission, loses half of the contracts with the school. So they have to reduce their staff from 8 to 4. Certainly the tenured teachers would have priority in that RIF situation, assuming that they're qualified and eligible and can still, perform the remaining services. They would also have priority in reemployment. They would be on a reemployment list and they would have priority. And Justice Lavecchia, to your question about
the board's, you know, good faith, bad faith. There is a case, an appellate division case called, I'm going to mess up this name too, Weimeister, from 1949, that talks about how a board cannot conduct a RIF in bad faith. They can't. In that case, it was a principal was let go, and they established a new position of teaching principal that was the same, essentially the same duties, but they were just trying to help a friend or something. Mm-hmm. And the court said, you know, you can't. You have to look a little bit behind the reasons right. that the board has given and try to determine whether there was a good faith RIF or not, because a RIF is based on economics.
Do you subscribe to the position that Sussex County has advanced?
I'm sorry?
Do you subscribe to the position that they've advanced short of a RIF because of the fluctuation in hours and the way the contract is written in this case? Management can reduce hours of tenured employees and give them to non-tenured. Do you believe that that's permissible under the Tenure Act?
I would rephrase it, but what I would say is that it's not their hours. There isn't, with these employees, they are not guaranteed any particular number of hours, so they don't have hours that are given to somebody else.
Understood.
So
you,
I would
you
say
believe,
that
you believe
hours can be, they fluctuate. As uncomfortable as the concept is of reducing, you know, having a teacher have way fewer hours the next, you know, in a subsequent year, if we are going to maintain the employment contract that they have, which allows for fluctuating hours, they have to be allowed to fluctuate, and they can't only fluctuate up, which is the way it would be otherwise. So it's a very unusual, difficult.
But can they fluctuate down merely because the board wants to pay the teacher who has just graduated from school half or a third of the salary of the tenured teacher?
I mean, certainly we would not want that. But I think if there were, it would go to the good faith. I think you could, if there was an honest good faith argument to be made. The problem is that
the board just wants to do it to save money.
The problem is that we can't litigate every time hours fluctuate. I mean, that's the problem when we have, we're going to honor these employment contracts that involve fluctuating hours without rewriting them, then the hours are going to fluctuate.
So surely there has to be a measure of reason that would apply to that I'll call it a logistical/legal problem. But given the discomfort that you recognize as well, is there a better formula? Is there a better approach than the one that leads us to potentially 1 hour?
I mean, obviously, that's not the case here, I should just point out. So we haven't seen that case.
Right.
But without rewriting the contract and without rewriting the statute, which is a possibility, I suppose, the legislature could say that these types of contracts are illegal. As far as I know, they are not. A board can legitimately enter into an hourly rate contract without fixed number of hours with their employees. And so the question is, how do we honor that?
Why couldn't the commissioner just look at this as, without calling it a RIF, in effect it is a RIF, and examine it based upon the standards we would use in that setting?
Because I don't know that there was actually a reduction in hours. I mean, I think if it were a situation where either staff was being let go or one of the appellate division cases, Alfieri or Cortizas, said that if there was a consolidation of positions and so it seemed like a RIF, then yes, I think we could look at it that way. But I think, as all of you were looking at before, there are situations where hours will fluctuate for very legitimate reasons. You could imagine a situation where a non-tenured teacher worked Monday and Wednesday from 8 to 12 in one school, and a tenured teacher worked Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 8 to 12 in another school. And the tenured teacher was providing tutoring or something to a student who left the district or got sick and was out for a month. So their hours reduced. The hours aren't fungible. That tenured teacher can't be reassigned to the other school to pick up some hours that are at the same time that the teacher is supposed to teach in their own school. And we have to remember that we're talking about
We're not talking about people sitting in a room doing data entry. We're talking about people working with children who are teaching them, and they develop a relationship with the children. And from an educational standpoint, you don't want to keep switching hours around just to satisfy some kind of weekly tenure obligation and harm the children who are trying to, you know, be the ones that are going to benefit from this.
You're explaining very well what are the rationale behind doing exactly what this school district did. Do you think we ought to be able to at least say to them, because presumably it's happening when they're figuring out who's teaching where, what, when for the school year, even during the school year, presumably somebody's sitting in a room with somebody else saying, well, we can't use this teacher anymore, we have to use that teacher, that they ought to at least be able to tell somebody that instead of just saying, we don't need a reason, we like you, we don't like you, we're not giving you hours, we're giving you hours. Isn't that, I mean, you're giving us very rational reasons. We have no idea that any of those rational reasons existed in this case. Do you think we ought at least be able to ask for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if as my colleague mentioned, you know, the collective negotiations agreement could include something in it, the legislature could change.
Not even saying it has to. Not even getting there, not suggesting there's a riff, not suggesting, I'm not, anyway. Hours can go up, hours can go down, whatever. We get it. I understand what you're saying. I think you've explained very rationally why that happens. Do you think we ought to at least know that it's happening for the reasons, like the reasons you're giving, instead of like, I woke up on Monday and didn't like John, I liked Mary better, and so she's getting the hours.
Well, certainly if they woke up and said, I don't want to give it to John because he's a man, or because of his race.
No, don't take me too literally. You get what I'm saying.
I know, and I feel the discomfort, and I feel like the best way for them to, you know, say our, you know, if you wanted to have some kind of rule that said that hours should be assigned first to, you know, tenured staff, or made sure that all tenured staff had the hours,
tenured, so it would have to be people who are qualified.
Right.
And you'd have to take into account continuity in terms of the teaching relationship
with
the children.
Right, and I believe, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, and you could probably enlighten us, but I believe that a lot of the teachers are assigned, you know, to a school, and they develop a relationship with in this situation.
And
so,
if that's true, I'm not even sure we should be talking about a rule. I have no idea what that rule would look like. I have no idea how this gets calculated. You get past 2 and 2, and you may lose me. So what I'm suggesting is that, like a lot of other areas of the law, if there's a rational basis, if they can explain it, and it's rational, it's not irrational, it's not unreasonable, it's not arbitrary, okay. They're saying, I don't even have to do that. I get up one morning and I want to give this person more and this person less. I'm entitled to under the statute and the contract. I don't know, it's not the way I ever read the statute. I don't know about the contract.
I think the problem is that the contract, so as I said before, the statute gives, the contract gives substance to what is protected by the tenure law. We may not like the contract. We may not want to enter into that contract, and maybe the teachers don't like that contract, but I don't think there's anything illegal about it, so I don't know what we can.
I don't think, you
know,
nobody's arguing that. And the contract reads perfectly reasonable to me. But when I sit here and I'm picturing collective bargaining agreements, they sit at the table with certain assumptions. I mean, and reasonable assumptions. There is some meeting of the minds, what's going to affect the bargaining unit collectively and what's going to affect the government entity. Shouldn't they actually have that meeting and understanding as to what that is so that you can't reduce the hours of these tenured teachers to one? I mean, I don't know. I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean,
We're sitting here listening to somebody saying, you don't need that rational meeting of the minds.
I'm not sure I under.
Well,
I mean, are you saying that the commissioner should impose something, or the court, or
no?
Apparently
they made a decision. You've given us a lot of reasons why teachers work more hours and less hours. There's a whole lot of geography, certificates, all that stuff. Very good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Reduction in numbers of pupils per teacher, or increase in the number of pupils. A lot of good reasons. Presumably, somebody sits in a room, collectively, a group sits in a room and says, we need this many teachers here, this many teachers there. We have to do all these things. We have to make this calculation. So teacher A gets X and gets this many hours, teacher Y gets this many hours. Shouldn't they at least be able to tell us that and make sure it's not just so arbitrary that there's, frankly, doesn't appear to have been any meeting of the minds in the collective bargaining agreement? Or shouldn't they have to at least tell us that? What was the rationale? As opposed to no rationale.
Well, I thought that they did get, I mean, they did.
Not in this case.
Okay.
So you pointed to me in the record.
Let me try it this way.
I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry.
No. Your question was quite wise.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not helping.
You have a thoughtful invitation from the appellate division for the commissioner to come forward with a proposal here. And I understand why that wouldn't happen while this litigation is pending. But if the court doesn't accept that the only metric, the only measure, is has the hourly wage changed, does the commission have a proposal? I don't know whether you have one now or whether that's something that the commissioner would come back with.
Well, I've thought about it. And I the problem is you could either say that they must have some sort of guarantee of annual compensation, which is not in the statute, so that would probably be a problem. Or we would have to rewrite their employment contract to give them a guaranteed minimum level of hours, or you know, just pay them more per hour at the end of the year so that they end up with what they had the year before, which is also, I mean, we can't really, I'm not really sure how we do this.
You understandably want some fluctuation based on need built in.
Right.
Is there a way to factor that in to the appropriate approach that protects tenure rights?
I don't know of a way to do it without changing their contract or changing the statute. I mean, if their contract said, you know, you're guaranteed at least, you know, 10 hours a week, and then I'm not even sure how that would work, honestly, because then
they may not have the 10 hours a week.
They might not have 10 hours, and then at the one week they go up to 15 hours, then is that their new baseline? Are they only fluctuating up? And pretty soon they become full-time teachers.
Well, what's so difficult,
this is
pivoting off of Justice Solomon, the board just gives reasons to the tenured teacher why his or her hours are being reduced. They could be because of the geographical distances, because the non-tenured teacher has a certificate, continuity of teaching. It's not a perfect paradigm, but it certainly might remove arbitrary decision making, no?
So I see. So you're suggesting, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand who the board was giving the explanation to. So you're saying that could we somehow require the board when they set the hours to sort of explain why they're doing it that way?
I'm suggesting.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be one approach?
This court could do that, I suppose. I mean, I don't know that the commissioner has the authority to order boards to give that. And then I guess the question would be, how do we judge that when they then challenge it? Like, what is a good enough reason?
We'll be the judge of that. Don't
Pardon?
We'll be the judge
oh, okay.
of that.
Let me ask you, there's been there's a lot of discussion in the record about the unique nature of this commission and the nature of the students whom it is serving, being non-public school students, and there's obviously a need for the teachers to go to different schools. But it seems to me that perhaps this problem has come up in the context of public schools, as to which a teacher is a group of qualified teachers. They're going to multiple schools within a district. There is fluctuation, maybe a smaller, more rural district. There is fluctuation, and there are times when there is no or very minor demand. There's times perhaps when there's more, and there are different qualifications that make one teacher qualified to handle a particular type of class and another not. Has this part-time, no minimum number of hours come up in other contexts that may not look exactly like this because of this sort of unique commission status, but might have come up in a Board of Ed situation where the school district is sending teachers, deploying teachers for particular reasons, and has a CNA that, you know, for very good reasons, doesn't provide a minimum number of hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually the Alfieri case was
Alfieri
against
is one,
yes,
right. And I'm wondering whether there is anything has been done to think about how a formula might be derived, just thinking outside of the commission kind of box a little bit, for that might apply to a broader group of situations.
I mean, I haven't seen any studies on this, but my sense is that most part-time teachers are of the type that they were discussing before. Like
three-fifths,
the art teacher in elementary school who doesn't need to work, you know, a full year or whatever.
Educational services commissions have been around for decades, haven't they?
Yes.
Okay, and they've been providing exactly this kind of services on-site at non-public schools at least since the 1980s.
Right. In fact, this court in Impe, I think it was called, had a case where a teacher was let go because the district was going to contract with an educational services commission because they could do it at a lower cost. So it's been around for a long time.
In your experience, is this contract a common one with no minimum hours, no minimum salary?
I wouldn't want to, you know, say something I don't know. I really don't know how common it is.
Ms. Ahrens, just one last question, at least for me. I would assume that the commissioner would agree that minimally, in all instances, a teacher is entitled to expect non-arbitrary and non-capricious actions and decision-making by their Board of Education or management. You would agree with that, right?
Absolutely.
That's not something that has to be bought through a collective bargaining agreement,
no.
Does it?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Just that, our position is that the court should reverse the appellate division and find, consistent with the commissioner's decision, that the teacher's tenure rights were not violated here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Buceri.
May it please the court. The essence of the decision below is one of law. We never got to the point where we could flesh out all of the hours, although the record does reflect the timesheets of the non-tenured people. The timesheets reflect the fact that Chapter 192 work was more than available to fill out the schedules of the two petitioners. These petitioners were reduced, one by 72%, another by 30%. They had whole days of the week when they had no work, which could have been filled with the work of other non-tenured teachers. The situation that we're facing in terms of defining the word compensation arises before there were contracts, collectively negotiated contracts. It goes back 100 years. In those days, the salaries were set by the school board, and that was it. And the word compensation referred to the annual compensation of the employee. You asked about other hourly employees. Well, there are custodians and there are secretaries, and there are lots of people with tenure, and they all have the same reduction in the compensation language. A lot of them are hourly with no minimums or maximums. Most of the contracts that are hourly have maximums to prevent people from getting health insurance. But other than that, very few have minimums because in most cases, especially in this area of special education and remedial education, there is a fluctuation. But this has been going on for decades. My clients, Ms. Zimmerman, had 28 and 29 hours a week fluctuations from 2004 till 2014, 10 years. We had no problems organizing the situation in terms of distributing work. The tenured people get work first. When their schedules are filled, the other work goes to the non-tenured people. It's that simple.
How do you respond to the argument that you could have negotiated a minimum number of hours into the contract, but didn't, and you're asking the court to do that?
Because the tenure law has nothing to do with what's negotiated in contracts. It's been established for decades that a contract can't control what the statute says. When the legislature established tenure, they could have just said that you have tenure in your position and that your only rights arise when you lose that position. But they didn't say that. They said if there's a reduction in your compensation, you have an opportunity to assert your tenure rights and claim that compensation.
We don't know what negotiations went on between the collective bargaining unit and the board. They may very well have come to the decision that they're fluctuating, so we just won't put this in the contract.
It's possible they did, but it doesn't matter whether they did or not, because they can't control what the tenure law requires.
So what are you entitled to, given the fact that there is fluctuation in this area?
The practice, let's take it out of the hourly context and put it in the part-time salaried context, where they get a percentage. The law is that if a person accretes time over time from year to year, if they go from one-half to one-fifth to, or no, three-fifths or four-fifths, whatever they're at is their entitlement. That's the Carlson case. Teacher who started out part-time and wound up being full-time in her third year, after her third year, when she earned tenure.
But doesn't have the facts here.
Not the facts here, no.
Not at all.
Well, it is, in a way it is, because these people accreted the time over periods of time. Ms. Zimmerman started out at 3 hours a week.
This is not a part-time agreement. This is separate and independent from that.
Well, it wasn't in any contract or agreement, sir. This is the interpretation of the tenure law.
Does your position take into account the educational needs of the students, which is talked about? Let me
Absolutely.
Just ask you an example. Let's say your client does not get the hours she wants. There's a non-tenured teacher. We're now in January, who's been working in September 192, so everybody's qualified, so working in September since September with a group of three students in a particular school. Does your client have the right to assert that she should get that class from now until June?
It would depend on why she lost the time. You see, this all took place at the beginning of the year, not.
Yeah,
I'm just
trying to understand the parameters of your position.
Let's say that one of the schools closed, a private school can close, and so that person had no more work in that school
because the school contracted with somebody else.
They would have bumping rights against a non-tenured teacher.
So she would be able to bump out of the ongoing class a non-tenured teacher, and if the commission determined that that was had a negative impact on the education of these special ed students, that's of no moment.
It's not of no moment.
I understand.
If she was certified to teach the special ed student, yeah. The way this works in terms of tenure and seniority is that bumping rights supersede unless there is something in terms of the law that says a certain certificate is required for the job.
So okay. Does that apply in the situation where there's a genuine good faith retraction of the overall need? There are fewer students this particular year who need these kinds of services.
That's a reduction in force. If we start the year out and we divide up the work that exists and we find there's less work than there was before, there are fewer schools, there are fewer students, whatever it is, the work goes first to the tenured person, and then to the less senior tenured person, and then to the non-tenured person based on their certifications.
So they get the same percentage you were using, one-fifth, two-fifth.
It would be the amount of compensation. The one-fifth, two-fifth determines the compensation, but that's for people who are salaried. For these people, the compensation is the amount they earn.
So I just wanted to ask you a question about continuity. This was a question Justice Patterson was asking. So imagine the tenured teacher has three students and the non-tenured has three students, and we're 8 months into the educational year, and the tenured teacher's students wind up leaving the district.
Yes.
Are you saying that under the tenure law, the tenured teacher now has the right to bump the non-tenured teacher when there's like 2 months left in the educational season?
In theory, if their salary is eliminated or reduced because the students
Forget
left,
about
yes.
In theory, because
well,
yes,
yeah, it's
reality.
Possible to preserve the salary regardless.
Would the board be violating the teacher's tenure rights, okay, or acting arbitrarily by allowing the non-tenured teacher to remain on to complete the educational mission for that year?
Under the way the law operates, yes. It would be the same situation if there was a regular contracted teacher who was working and then her class was eliminated for whatever reason, combined with another class. That teacher would have the right to bump in the middle of the year. That's always been the case.
So your argument is that essentially, by practice, these tenured hourly teachers have a floor in their contracts because they've established a floor through the prior work that they've been assigned.
They don't have a floor in their contract. They have a statutory floor based on the amount of compensation that they've earned.
And that's the, that would be if they, if you take the two teachers together who are tenured, they get the first 50 hours.
Whatever the hours would be, yes.
So basically they are entitled to wherever those hours are, whatever classroom, whatever, wherever we are in the year, if they are qualified to teach the particular class, they get off the top the first 50 or 60 or 70.
And that's the way it's worked for decades, okay? The situation that these people have had is that they were given work year after year. Now,
I understand they were given work year after year, but I didn't see in this record that they have always gotten the first, you know, X lopped the first number of hours.
It doesn't
off.
Have to be the first as long as it's there.
But you know what I'm saying. Yeah. You understand what I mean, that they get first priority to the total amount, up to the amount that they want.
There are more than just these two who are tenured, but yes.
I understand, yeah.
The way the percentage method that the Appellate Division attempted to reach, while I agree that it was only a recommendation and they allowed the commissioner discretion, it would not work, unfortunately. First of all, because the law guarantees compensation, it doesn't guarantee percentage of hours. And compensation and hours are not necessarily the same thing. In addition, it's apportioning time between tenured and non-tenured people. So a tenured person may have 20% of the available work in 1 year, and the next year, if there's less work, they couldn't. That 20% is less money, and yet the other work is going to non-tenured people. Percentages also don't work because the base that you use for the calculation changes depending on what certificate you hold. If there's 2,000 hours of K to 8 work and 500 hours of K 9 to 12 work, and you're only certified K to 8, well, you get your percentage is based on that pool. But if you're certified in both high school and elementary, then your percentage is based on a larger pool, and that's a different figure, even though you may be more senior than the other person. Percentages don't work, but they're not needed. What we've been doing has been working. It's a matter of distributing work.
Your argument, Mr. Busiri, is based on the accretion that you explained, that whatever their last highest salary is, that's the amount that they should not be reduced from.
Their last salary. If a person accepts a reduction, in other words, from 1 year to the next, okay, they don't challenge it, then that's their new base.
So the point in comparison here is the 2013-14 year.
Yes.
And what if the total, here theoretically, what if the total number of educational hours drops below the level at which that salary can be paid even for the one teacher?
Then that's a reduction in force, and their salary goes down. That's a reduction in force. That's what a reduction in force is, a reduced need for staff. And there are logistical issues here, too. A person can't be in two places at once. So if the school, one school needs somebody to work on Monday morning doing something with Johnny and Jane, and another school needs them to be there at Monday morning for Sam and Elliot, they can't be both in the same place. And so the non-tenured person can get that if there's no tenured person who can be assigned to it.
Right, but assuming everything's equal, if there's a 20% reduction of hours, it's your position, that's got to come off the
non-tenured.
Right.
Okay. You said as long as they don't challenge, the salary from last year remains
right.
The minimum.
Is my clients have had slight fluctuations in the past.
Please. Is there a practical reason that someone wouldn't challenge, assuming they wanted to work the hours?
But if you've only lost $300 and it's because of a change in students or something that's legitimate, there's no reason to challenge.
Right, for de minimis.
Exactly.
But beyond that, it seems like you're setting a minimum.
The board is setting a minimum by assigning the work to the person. If it's more than the year before, that's the new minimum. But the board chooses how much to assign up once you get to the point that they had it before. If they choose to give them more, they could have kept Ms. Zimmerman at 3 hours a week for her entire career if they wanted to. But they didn't. They raised her compensation to the level that it reached. And that's the level that's protected by the statute.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.